start with a disclaimer. Not a crop modeler. So I'll give you a few minutes if you need to exit. What I'm instead doing is representing a broad integrating project in which the crop modeling and AgMet play a very important role in ensuring that our integration is successful. And maybe sort of an example of how that can look for different AgMet partners. So these four pictures show cropping systems, examples of them in the Pacific Northwest, the USA. These are all cereal production systems, but they differ in because the temperature regimes and precipitation regimes and soils and terrain all differ across the region. We have quite a heterogeneous climate with, for example, precipitation where wheat production can occur, ranging from 12 centimeters annual of rain all the way up to three or four times of that. And you can see the map shows the footprint of our project. And our project is motivated by this situation. These are downscaled projections from the global models for climate trends in that region, those three states in which our project is located. See, with RCP 4.5 and 8.5, you can see by end of century. In the summer, we have warming and drying, fairly good agreement amongst the models. And in the winter, some increase in temperatures, but less certainty around the precipitation possibly increasing. But this is going to, of course, impose some changes in our cropping systems and the way the farmers need to optimize their practices. So because of that, because dealing with that is a broadly interdisciplinary issue, we conceived of and were very happy to be funded by the National Institute for Food and Agriculture to conduct this project, which is a number of goals regarding the implementation of approaches and technology to impart resilience to climate change in these systems and also reduce greenhouse gas emissions, work closely with producers through that, and educate K through next generations, K through 20. We have 9 disciplinary and integrating objectives. So the project includes biologists, agronomists, climate modelers, economists, entomologists, sociologists, educators, and we have 3 institutions, 3 land-grant institutions in the U.S., and about 200 participants across the whole project, counting PIs and everybody else. So we're doing a lot of integration. There's a picture there of one of our annual meetings, and we also have some really good project advisors. One of them is Sentolt. I think he's about two-thirds of the way across that crowd of people there. What we do in the project is to integrate all these different disciplinary dimensions, and these pictures are meant to illustrate those. So there are examples of experiments underway to look at greenhouse gas emissions, hydrological conditions in fields and runoff of nitrates, greenhouse gas emissions as measured by flux towers, working with producers, biological sampling, and experiments in the field with different kinds of applications of insecticide is shown there. Fertilizer implementation is shown there. And we have experiments that occur throughout the region to help validate the work and examine different approaches to adapting to climate change. So we can structure the whole project this way. With the experiments, the extension, and the education, but you can see that at the center we have some modeling, crop system modeling, climate models, and economic models, and we couple those in order to inform the work and also understand some of our results. So that leads to our partnership with AgMep, because central in this diagram is the crop model. And the crop model that we use primarily is CropSyst. It is calibrated from our monitoring field sites, and we've used it, and I'm going to give you some examples of how we use the cropping system model in the project, looking at within-field variation and crop performance using CropSys microbasin application, generating some regional projected performance of our cropping systems under climate change, incorporating potential impacts of pest injury in the system, and forming regional economic models. And also, as part of, as a partner with AgMIP, working on the national data harmonization efforts that are underway. So those are our three models again. So these are the examples. So the within field variation in crop performance. This is work, and all the work I'm going to show you slides of here is by students within the project, and these are publications that are in various stages of preparation or submission. So Nicole Ward has done this work with CropSys looking at within field variation. We have extremely complex terrain in our region, and it turns out that it's quite important to understand the variability in crop yield and performance across these heterogeneous fields. So the inputs for modeling like this, if this is a 10 by 10 meter pixel, so really downscaling from what was discussed in the previous talk, to provide some outputs such as water balance parameters, nutrient parameters, crop parameters, yield biomass, and nitrogen uptake, and soil parameters, all at this finer spatial scale. This is relevant to some of the practices farmers are engaged in with precision agriculture, but it allows us to employ the modeling. And this is just an example of type of output with, this was CropSys generated, an example field where we have the cross-section there. The two lines show the soil surface and the argillic layer in this particular crop profile, this terrain profile, with a single nitrogen application rate, the bushels per acre production that is potentially achieved at those different locations across the field. So this work has been done in this particular case for one of our locations, but here's a map of the region with locations where this type of within field at fine scale, fine gridded simulations will be done. And at the bottom is a picture of one of our fields where you can see very clearly, visually, the type of heterogeneity that occurs there. For climate, we use our climatologists in the project, and this is, in some ways, we're like a sort of self-contained little module of AgMIP because we have our climate modelers as well. And John Abatsoglu, co-author on this talk, and his team use the multivariate adaptive constructed analog. With these variables considered, using the GCMs and then downscaling to a 4-kilometer grid for the western United States with at a daily time scale. And these can be run historically, and we can also use the projections, and this is done with the 14 GCMs. Here's just an example of output. It's just kind of a fun movie. This is an example of maximum temp accumulated precipitation and downward shortwave flux across the western U.S. This is October 20th through 25th in 2045, just to help you with a little planning in case whatever you're going to be doing in 2045. And this is an example year for 2045, but you can see the fronts moving across the region, and we get a very nice downscaled fine simulation based on the inputs of the weather patterns that can be expected at those scales. So how do we use that? There's a number of examples across the project. Here's one. PhD student Tina Karimi has been using CropSys to look at conventional and reduced tillage historical yields, and then downscaling those, again, on this gridded, with this gridded output, for 2030, 2050, and 2070, or year samples, bracketing those dates under the two common tillage practices that in our region. What you can see is, at least for our region, this does include CO2 fertilization in these models, that we have yield increases projected over most of the region, some of them fairly considerable. Another thing that can be done with CropSys is to look at N2O projections. So here's some downscale projections for nitrous oxide emissions in milligrams of CO2 equivalents per hectare per year. Again, these two snapshots are for 4.5, 2070. You can see that under reduced tillage versus conventional tillage is slightly different patterns with, in general, mostly staying the same. We're not getting much differences, but we're getting some increases in nitrous oxide emissions with this modeling approach in some locations across the region. Another thing we can do using the same, and this is also some of Tina's work, approach, is to look at what producers are doing on the ground. And under the assumption that producers will use the cropping system that produces the best return for them, or the highest yield in this case, and then under projections based on those different cropping systems, project what do we expect farmers to be doing on the ground in the future. So here's an example output from that. So we have these colors here on the map to the left shows you high rainfall, intermediate rainfall, and low rainfall zones, and the predominant cropping systems there. So crop on crop under high rainfall, crop with fallow, and alternating crop fallow in the low rainfall zone. And then under the assumption that these, as I mentioned, that farmers will choose and employ the best system, you can see from 2030 through 2070 shifts in the what kinds of cropping systems we can expect on the ground in those different grids. One take home here is that the projections based on this is that you can look at CCF, that the crop with intermittent fallow is projected to go down quite a bit in the future scenarios. This can be compared with some other approaches to projecting farmer practices in the future to teach us more about what we can expect about these systems going forward. Another challenge that we're trying to address, which all crop modelers are approaching globally, is how to incorporate pest injury into these models. So we have chosen to work with the cereal leaf beetle, which is Ulema melanopus. It's an invasive pest of our region, at least in the last 20 years. It feeds on wheat, as you can see in the top right photograph there, by producing these strips where it removes the tissue. There's the adult beetle. That blob there is a larva. And it is a serious pest of wheat worldwide. Right now, it's under relatively good control in the Northwest because of biological control. But other models I won't have time to go into today indicate that that biological control could be jeopardized by a phenological mismatch between the pest and its principal natural enemy. So it's important for us to include some projections on cereal leaf beetle impacts. So what Baiju Govindan has done, as a postdoc in the project, is first conduct chamber studies in which we simulate or in which we measure feeding by cereal leaf beetle at all of its developmental instars under elevated temperatures and elevated CO2, so we can look into reasonable future scenario with respect to conditions, and then use the output from that to create a module to insert into CropSys so we can look at the impacts on biomass. So what I'm showing here is feeding biomass reduction in the charts, but we can extend that to projections on eventual yield of the crop. So the figure shows two locations in our region, Pullman, Washington, and Lynn, Washington, which differ in their current climatic temperature accumulation curves and water patterns of precipitation. And we can see that feeding biomass reduction, this is reduction in the biomass of the plant after going through the CropSys module is increased. So biomass reduction is increased under these delta temperatures. And in addition, additively with that, with the elevated CO2. If those of you know something about insects, know that by and large, insects that feed on green plant tissue consume more of the tissue that's been grown under high CO2 because the nitrogen concentration in the tissue goes down under high CO2, forcing the animals to eat more. So that's what you see there in that pattern. But in Lynn, the biomass reduction of the plant at the elevated temperatures is not what you see in Pullman. This is because of a non-intuitive emergent property, if you will, of the wheat plant, which is that it's filling its biomass from below ground reserves during the time that the beetle is feeding, which is not the case in Pullman, where new photosynthate is being incorporated. So we didn't expect that. This is going to allow us to make a gridded output of this type of data, similar to the other ones, and look at probably, I'm anticipating, some non-intuitive patterns in the heterogeneity of cereal-leaf beetle impact under future climate. What else are we doing? I think you're familiar, if you're part of the AgMIP community, and the effort led by Jim Jones to develop a national network, National Agricultural Research Data Network, to enable crop comparisons, crop model comparisons, which includes the generation of these nodes shown here in this cartoon. The nodes include, one of the nodes will be our project's node, which is the REACH data portal and Northwest Knowledge Network. So we're contributing to and benefiting from AgMIP's efforts too, anticipating that this network will be funded and we can help with that. So I think I got the 2-minute warning. Was that 2 minutes until 20 minutes or 2 minutes until the hook? Yeah, okay. Got it. So here's that model again of our project, or diagram of the project. Just wanted to point out that AgMIP really impinges on what we're doing throughout our modeling efforts and also our data management and cyber infrastructure dimensions. So we think we're good contributors to AgMIP community, and we're certainly beneficiaries of the AgMIP community. So I'll stop and thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Sanford. Do we have any questions for start over there. Let's start here.
Oh, you got
we had already a question before we started.
So I'll see if I can answer this, but In order, we can measure the variance. What I showed you, all these outputs are means, but the way we have been running the models is to run each GCM separately on each grid location, so we can also produce a map of the variance of the outputs and kind of assess that and how that varies across the landscape. I don't know if it gets quite to your question, but it does provide a way of thinking about the issue you raise.
What you're doing is feeding extra variance in by using GCNs to create that initial push. One of the comments that I would make to you is that I'm wondering how much of the loss in variation you get with scaling is not due to amplification of the model's own behavior.
Yeah, that's a really good. That's a good question, and at this point, unless Claudio corrects me, you know, we're using the means for the field. We're not trying to incorporate that in-field heterogeneity nested within the regional. That's not where we're going. Correct. It's quite big, as you saw. Yes. It would be interesting to look at that sensitivity, because across the region too, as you go westward, that terrain relaxes a little bit. We don't have such a strong, you know, within-field signal, so it might affect the kind of projections we make in the different zones. And I forgot, this is my last slide. I'm sorry it's so small, but I forgot to put it onto the projector. But this is, Sintel mentioned our conference that just ended on Sunday morning, really, which is a global network on integrated approaches to addressing changes in cereal production semi-arid regions. I have these cards. We're continuing to have that conversation beyond the meeting, and here's the website so that you can connect with that network if you'd like. Come see me, I'll give you a card.
Thanks, Antoine.